Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Wade T. Eames, MD, an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and Shaley Shaw, MD, MS, an assistant professor in the Neuroimmunology Division at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, to discuss Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome in small cell lung cancer and other neuroendocrine cancers. In our exclusive interview, Doctors Eames and Shaw explain the symptoms associated with LEMS, including autonomic symptoms, which distinguish the condition from other disorders such as myasthenia gravis. They also delineate the different classifications of LEMS, which can be divided into paraneoplastic LEMS, which is triggered by an underlying cancer, and non-paraneoplastic LEMS, which is primarily an antibody-mediated disease. Additionally, Dr. Eames and Dr. Shaw explain the process of diagnosing patients with LEMS, how LEMS affects patient prognoses, and the primary goals of delivering coordinated care with both LEMS and cancer treatments to maximize patient functionality and optimize their quality of life. Thank you so much to our guests today, Dr. Eames and Dr. Shaw, joining us on an episode of EncLive On Air to discuss LEMS in small cell and other cancers. How are you both doing today?
Doing well.
Doing great. Thank you.
All right. So getting started, what is LEMS really, and what are some of the symptoms associated with it?
So Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome is a disorder of neuromuscular transmission at the level of the nerve head. The communication between the nerve and the muscle is not working appropriately. And we believe this is an antibody or an autoimmune mediated process. Some of the main symptoms associated with it are progressive fatigable weakness, primarily in the thighs and the upper proximal legs. You sometimes see weakness in the shoulder girdle muscles as well, but that's less common. In about a third of them, you can see bulbar symptoms, meaning dysarthria, double vision, changes in swallowing, but it's a little bit rarer than one of its primary sort of differentials, myasthenia gravis. One of the main distinguishing features, and something that I teach about often, is that autonomic symptoms are quite prominent in Lambert-Eaton. So 90% of them will have autonomic symptoms. The most common symptom they'll mention is dry mouth, sometimes dry eyes. In men, it tends to be issues with erectile dysfunction. But over the course of their disease, they'll have issues with urination, issues with bowels and constipation. They may have changes in their sweating. They may develop sluggishly reactive pupils, a number of different symptoms related to different aspects of the autonomic system.
And you mentioned autoimmune related. Are there different types of LEMS, and are there known risk factors for each?
So Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome is typically classified into two different entities, and that's a paraneoplastic entity, which is associated with an underlying cancer, and a non-paraneoplastic or primarily antibody-mediated disease, both of which can have antibodies to the PQ calcium channel antibody. But there are some additional antibodies that we check for in sort of the autoimmune neurology world that can sometimes be more often present in those who also have cancer. It's about a 50-50 split, but we typically evaluate all patients for a malignancy upon diagnosis. Because small cell lung cancer is the most commonly associated malignancy, the only sort of risk factors that we are able to identify are really those that pertain to that. So an extensive history of tobacco use or smoking, and then older age.
So then with that said, do patients with LEMS typically present to medical oncologists first?
Sometimes the diagnosis of Lambert-Eaton precedes the diagnosis of the cancer, in which case we will refer to our colleagues after diagnosis. And Dr. Eames can probably say a little bit more about those who present in the opposite way.
Absolutely. Some patients, we have a diagnosis of small cell lung cancer, typically by CT imaging and biopsy confirmation. And what we observe from the oncology perspective is out of proportion, and as Dr. Shah has described, often proximal muscle weakness or other neurologic symptoms without an additional imaging explanation. And then those are circumstances where, from the oncology perspective, we'll loop in our neuro-oncologists for concerns for neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes, such as LEMS.
And you mentioned small cell already. Are there any other common cancers that LEMS is found in?
Any neuroendocrine malignancy is kind of more broadly how I would describe it. Small cell lung cancer is the most common neuroendocrine malignancy, but there are neuroendocrine cancers that can arise from a variety of organs, and even most adenocarcinomas can transform to neuroendocrine. So I would, taking a step back, lump it into that broader category of any neuroendocrine carcinoma could have that association in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. But specifically, we see thymic cancers and sometimes lymphomas in addition. With the thymic cancers, it sometimes can be tricky to diagnose because our studies are not always protocols to evaluate the thymus appropriately. And it's a hypometabolic malignancy, so we don't always see it on PET scans. So then with that said, is there a specific tool or measurement or marker that is being used to diagnose LEMS? And I guess with some of the symptoms that you mentioned earlier, it seems like there could be a lot of overlap with other disorders. So are misdiagnoses common? The primary diagnostic tool as a neurologist is, of course, the clinical examination. So looking for fatigability on exam, looking for facilitation of reflexes before and after testing strength is something you can do. These patients, though, can sometimes have complaints that are a little bit out of proportion to their initial exam. So you may, unless you're looking very carefully, feel the exam is normal, unless your clinical suspicion is high. But ultimately, the diagnostic test of choice is the electrodiagnostic tools or a nerve conduction study or an EMG, which looks at stimulation of the muscles post-exercise or post-facilitation, where we'll see that the nerve conduction will actually have a decrement or improve based on sort of the stages at which you're sort of looking at it. We can also check for autoantibodies. I mentioned the calcium channel antibodies, but the absence of those antibodies does not exclude the disease. So oftentimes it's a very particular part of the EMG, that nerve, that facilitation component that often has to be specially requested in order to make the diagnosis. And so that's where, when I say the clinical suspicion needs to be high, it becomes very important so that you can ask for all of the correct tests. So then how does a diagnosis of LEMS affect a patient's prognosis, particularly those who are diagnosed with small cell lung cancer?
So there's an interesting body of literature in small cell lung cancer in particular, noting that first, historically, even decades ago, the observation was made that it seemed that patients with neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes like LEMS had better cancer control. And there have been retrospective cohorts from several institutions at this point describing that patients who develop LEMS in association with small cell lung cancer typically actually have an improved prognosis, almost a doubling of the overall survival medians. And here at Vanderbilt, we put together a follow-up series where we looked at the tumor tissue and observed that tumor infiltrating lymphocytes were higher in individuals who had any neurologic paraneoplastic syndrome, including it was predominantly LEMS. And what we suspect as far as a mechanism is that LEMS is being an autoimmune phenomenon indicative of better host immune recognition of the tumor, which in multiple cancer histologies, we've now seen that better host immune recognition can result in prolonged cancer control. Nonetheless, with small cell lung cancer patients who develop LEMS, particularly patients with stage 4 disease, it does remain a terminal disease for them, just an improved prognosis. So it's still a difficult navigation when these individuals need further treatment in deciding the safest strategy.
In the neurology literature, that's similarly shown that they do seem to have a little bit of a better prognosis as compared to those with small cell lung cancer without Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. But in the patients that are not paraneoplastic, the prognosis tends to be a little bit better. So then in terms of treatment, what would you say are some of the short and long-term goals for a patient with LEMS, and how do they work for or against treatment of the patient's cancer?
I think the primary goal, and Dr. Shah will comment too, it would be functionality and quality of life. And how can the treatments delivered for LEMS optimize that functionality and quality of life? And then from the cancer perspective, what more often than not is a terminal cancer diagnosis, how can you forestall or control the cancer for as long as possible with the cancer treatments you're delivering and try to maximize functionality? It is often a difficult calculation. One thing I'll throw in at this point that is really important for the audience to note the interaction between is that in patients with extensive stage or stage 4 small cell lung cancer, our standard of care regimens now include immune therapy, which can exacerbate underlying autoimmune disease. And it's often a very difficult treatment decision in using that for a patient with small cell lung cancer with LEMS because of the risk of exacerbating LEMS.
Oftentimes with Lambert-Eaton, we will first ask our oncology colleagues to guide treatment. And from our perspective, if we can manage the underlying cancer, we can manage the underlying Lambert-Eaton as well. In those who have treated lower stage tumors, we can oftentimes see partial remissions or even sometimes complete remissions in these patients without the need for ongoing immunotherapy. Oftentimes, we will give concomitant immunotherapy.
So you mentioned sort of the disease stage having an impact on treatment. What other factors are at play here, and how do the available treatment options compare?
We typically classify patients into sort of a mild, moderate, and a severe burden of disease. Those with mild disease, we can sometimes simply treat the tumor and not have to give any additional therapies. When the patient does have more moderate or severe disease, usually more pronounced autonomic symptoms, more pronounced weakness, sometimes bulbar symptoms that may be preventing them from eating or speaking, for example, those can put them into the category, into these higher categories, in which case we oftentimes will treat with concomitant immunotherapy. The vast majority of patients will receive either prednisone in various amounts, IV steroids up front, sometimes IVIG or plasmapheresis, all of which have shown some efficacy in treating the disease. There isn't entirely any consensus in terms of what immunotherapies, and when I use the word immunotherapy, I'm referring to not the immune checkpoint inhibitors, but there isn't as much consensus as to whether or not these immunosuppressant agents, which ones are best for this disease. So sometimes people will use azathioprine, CellCept, similar drugs that have been shown retrospectively to improve disease outcomes.
So you've already kind of alluded to this, but why is there a need for coordinated care for these patients? What are the advantages of having that?
I think it's key because from the earlier stage perspective, so patients with stage 1, 2, and 3 small cell lung cancer, which is also sometimes called limited stage small cell lung cancer, their treatment regimen is typically just cytotoxic chemotherapy and radiation. And that is, it's critical to work with neuro-oncology to be on the same page with who's delivering what immune suppression, because those would work together. But also it's critical in the stage 4 setting when immune checkpoint inhibitors, which upregulate the immune system, are part of our standard paradigm, and try to gauge with neuro-oncology what extent of disease or severity of disease is present and the risks and benefits of including that immune checkpoint inhibitor, how that may counteract the immune suppression that autoimmune neurology is considering.
So then once a patient is started on a treatment course, what does oncologic and neurologic monitoring involve?
From an oncologic standpoint, we're typically, with any treatment regimen, repeating imaging after the first 6 to 8 weeks. And then in small cell lung cancer in particular, we often repeat cross-sectional imaging with CT and MRI every 2 to 3 months. So it's quite thorough monitoring for the cancer.
From a neurology perspective, many of us will follow them and largely follow them clinically and assess for improvements or worsening. We may need to do more objective studies like swallow evaluations or repeat electrodiagnostics. We don't follow antibody titers. We don't know the clinical relevance of doing that at this point in time. Additionally, we will monitor them for the development of other associated paraneoplastic syndromes. So paraneoplastics or cerebellar degeneration is one of the more common coexistent paraneoplastic disorders. So we keep an eye out for that and typically let the oncologist sort of guide them from there.
So then looking to the future, what clinical trials, new regimens, or other advances in small cell lung cancer and or LEMS are you excited about?
In the small cell lung cancer field, there has been a lot of continued interest in novel immunotherapeutics. Admittedly, there was some recent big negative data. So I'm uncertain whether new immune checkpoint inhibitors will modify the treatment landscape in small cell lung cancer. So there are novel agents that are not targeting the immune system, such as cell cycle directed agents, epigenetic modifiers, and application of some of our cytotoxic chemotherapeutics earlier in the disease course, one of the newer ones being lurbinectedin. So without getting into too many tangents within that milieu of potential new treatment options in small cell lung cancer, I think that they would all potentially, ideally, improve at least progression-free survival for our patients with a severe prognosis here. And because I'm not certain, or I'm a little bit skeptical that new immune checkpoint inhibitors will modify the treatment landscape in a major way in the near future, I think that it would be more thinking of how they could actually move in accord with our management of the LEMS.
Broadly speaking, our understanding of the pathophysiology of these paraneoplastic diseases has evolved significantly in the past 20 years. At this point, there are some clinical trials that have begun for the first time in other antibody-mediated disorders like NMDA receptor encephalitis. But at this point in time, there have not been any that have extended to Lambert-Eaton.
Before we close, is there anything else that either one of you would like to emphasize to treating physicians?
It's a complicated course to navigate, regardless of if a patient has limited stage small cell lung cancer with LEMS or extensive stage small cell lung cancer with LEMS. I think working with the autoimmune neurology team and being on the same page with, to put it most broadly, immune modulating agents that both of us are administering, I think that's the key.
Absolutely. And oncologists tend to have a high clinical suspicion in these patients. And in general, I think that if patients come in with fatigable weakness and autonomic symptoms, you know, our clinical suspicion should be quite high in order to make sure that we're capturing all these patients and making sure that we're making the appropriate diagnosis and catching these tumors faster, diagnosing and managing sooner. You know, it's about 3% of small cell lung cancer patients that I think have Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. So it is a small portion, but there is significant disability associated with the disease. And so I just caution a high level of clinical suspicion.
This was really, really great. Thank you both so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.